Good morning to you all, and welcome to the first lecture of the 2018 Palliative Care Lecture Series. Hospice New Zealand would like to thank and acknowledge Kaner Research Trust New Zealand for their generous support and funding to deliver these free lectures. The lecture today will be recorded, and it will be available on the Hospice New Zealand website. Please be aware there will be an opportunity for questions at the end of the presentation. We would now like to introduce our guest speaker today, Dr. Sinead Donnelly. Dr. Donnelly is a consultant for internal medicine at Wellington Hospital, senior lecturer at the Otago School of Medicine, and adjunct professor at the School of Biological Sciences at Victoria University of Wellington. Welcome, Dr. Donnelly. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Jessica. Tēnā koutou, ata mārie, tēnā vermagen. I come from a long line of doctors since 1905, three generations and seven doctors. From my general practitioner grandfather, I have learnt the art of attending in medicine. From my physician father, I have learnt the art of observing. I am a palliative medicine physician for the past 25 years. I practice the art and science of palliative medicine. Slide 2. As a palliative medicine physician, I care for many hundreds of people over the past few years and each year who have advanced disease and who have died. And to begin with, I would like to remember and acknowledge all those people. I have worked and trained in Ireland, Scotland, and the United States, and have been in New Zealand for the past 8 years. My whole being cries out, "Do not do this," to the concept of legalizing euthanasia in this country. I'm going to present sections of the End of Life Choice Bill, which is before the Justice Health Select Committee until August of this year. And the first part will be based on a legal analysis which we've obtained on the impact on the healthcare practitioner. So the Justice Health Select Committee is open for public submissions, closing on the 20th of February. I will start with the material as it is detailed, specific and important. So the first half of the lecture is very wordy. This bill, proposed by David Seymour, to legalise both euthanasia, which is a lethal drug being administered to the patient, and assisted suicide, which is a lethal drug self-administered by the patient. The bill, if enacted, would compromise both ethical and good clinical practice for medical practitioners. This is not confined to those who object to participating. For those practitioners who might be willing to support euthanasia in some cases, this bill is so prescriptive that it overrides any discretion to exercise proper clinical judgment or to act in the best interests of the individual patient. Slide 3. The bill introduces a highly prescriptive regime directed to facilitating access to assisted suicide for all eligible persons. Once any eligible person expresses a wish for assisted suicide, and I'm using that term interchangeably with euthanasia, the regime sets down a series of mandatory steps that a medical practitioner must follow with the sole aim of facilitating that person's death. The only stop point in the process is if the patient changes their mind and decides not to proceed. While the bill conveys the impression that it describes a medical treatment, including by referring to the lethal drugs as medication, it in fact sets up a conveyor belt of essentially administrative steps that must be followed by the medical practitioner in all cases for all patients, regardless of the practitioner's clinical judgment of what will be the best care. This conflicts with both the duties of the practitioner and the Code of Patients' Rights. Slide 4. Medical practitioners who object to doing something required by the legislation will be obliged to inform the person that the support and consultation for end of life in New Zealand, called GENS group, will provide the name and contact details of a medical practitioner who will facilitate their assisted suicide. Medical practitioners who do not either follow the mandatory process that lead to euthanasia or assist in passing the patient on to GENS for the processes to be completed will be liable to criminal prosecution. The regime set out in the bill is straightforward, with very few checks between a patient expressing a wish to have the option of euthanasia and the administration of the lethal drug. Slide 5. The The regime is predicated on the basis that once an eligible patient has expressed this wish, then the relevant medical practitioners are obliged to follow a process which has the sole aim of facilitating that patient's death. In summary, the person expresses a wish, then a request form is completed. Eligibility is determined and checked by two medical practitioners, the second of which must be from the scanned list of practitioners who are already supportive of assisted suicide. A time and method is decided, and provided the appropriate forms have been completed, the lethal drug is administered. Oddly, the bill is drafted in mandatory terms, stating that a patient who wishes to have the option of assisted suicide must tell their attending medical practitioner. This person could be any medical practitioner chosen by the person. The bill does not refer to the concept of a principal health provider, and there's no requirement that the practitioner knows the patient or has been previously involved in their care. Slide 6. Medical practitioner is defined solely by reference to registration with the Medical Council and covers all scopes of practice, including provisional, as well as doctors still in vocational training. Once the wish is expressed, the bill sets a mandatory and tightly prescribed list of what the medical practitioner must do in response. Inform the patient of their prognosis and of the irreversible nature of assisted suicide. Slide 7. Continue to remind the person of their wish for assisted suicide at intervals determined by the progress of their illness. The first step also involves the bill's only assessment of the person's state of mind. The obligation on the medical practitioner, slide 8, to whom the wish is expressed is perfunctory. They are required to do their best to ensure that the person is free from pressure from any other person. But this obligation is then further limited to requiring only one thing. The medical practitioner who receives the request is only obliged to talk with other practitioners who are in regular contact with the patient and to any members of the patient's family that the patient specifically authorizes. The medical practitioner is not obliged to conduct any further inquiries. Slide 9. It is a key feature of the bill that simply by expressing a wish, the patient automatically commences the process of assisted suicide or euthanasia. There's no provision for a medical practitioner to provide advice to balance this option or to encourage the patient not to pursue this option. Once the wish is expressed, the medical practitioner must complete a prescribed form requesting assisted suicide. If the person doesn't wish to sign the form at that stage, the obligation is to keep reminding them of their wish nonetheless, and that continues. The registrar for assisted dying in the Ministry of Health is to be an employee of the Ministry of Health, although the bill does not require them to have any particular qualifications or experience. The registrar's only function on receiving the form is to register that it has been received. Once the request form has been completed, the patient's eligibility for assisted suicide or euthanasia is assessed. The eligibility criteria are critical to this regime, as once a patient is assessed as eligible, there are no further stop points for their protection. The eligibility criteria are broad, creating an essentially on-demand availability of assisted suicide or euthanasia. For patients with any significant physical or mental disability or chronic illness, including mental illness or terminal illness. Slide 10. The bill requires only that the person be over 18 and a New Zealand citizen or permanent resident, has either a terminal illness that is likely to end their life within 6 months, or a grievous and irremediable medical condition. The patient person needs to be in an advanced state of irreversible decline in capability. The obvious interpretation is that the person is becoming physically or intellectually disabled or has mental health issues that prevent them from being fully capable long-term. Slide 11. The patient self-assesses that they experience unbearable suffering that cannot be relieved in a manner that he or she considers tolerable. The breadth of the eligibility criteria means that any medical practitioner in any scope of practice who is dealing with a person with a serious disability or chronic illness, who is told by the person that they wish for assistance to end their life, is obliged to facilitate that request or facilitate referring them onto someone else who will do so. Slide 12. The bill requires a second opinion from a SCENS-nominated practitioner, and only from this group, on whether the set eligibility criteria are met. The SCENS group is to maintain a list of practitioners willing to act to facilitate assisted suicide. Slide 13. It is apparent that the bill intends to limit the practitioner's exercise of professional judgment as to the best interests of the patient. The bill is highly prescriptive and sets out all the steps that the practitioner is obliged to take for every patient, regardless of their view of whether these steps are appropriate or desirable for the patient's care. A medical practitioner who failed to take these steps would be in breach of their statutory obligations and subject to criminal prosecution. The bill thus appears to override the practitioner's duties of good clinical practice and ethical patient care. Next slide, slide 14. And the patient's rights to professional and ethical care under the code. The bill is silent on whether patients are to be informed that their medical practitioner is no longer acting in accordance with their best judgment of good care for them as an individual, but rather is following the mandatory steps prescribed in the legislation. Slide 15. The bill allows for the entire process from wish to death to be completed without the knowledge of the patient's next of kin, or indeed anyone other than the two doctors involved and the pharmacist who dispenses the drugs. From wish to death could be a matter of days. The bill allows, for example, a mentally ill 18-year-old to engage with SCENS practitioners and be assisted to suicide without the knowledge of their parents or principal healthcare providers within a few days of first contact. The bill provides that a person who dies under this process is taken for all purposes to have died as if euthanasia had not been provided. The cause of death for the death certificate is to be specified as if assisted dying had not been provided. Slide 16. The bill as currently drafted requires a practitioner who objects to facilitating assisted suicide, even if the objection is on clinical grounds specific to the patient, to step aside and pass that patient to a SCENS practitioner. This will be on the known basis that the SCENS practitioner is ideologically supportive of assisted suicide. It will also be on the basis that the SCENS practitioner is not tasked with caring for the patient, but merely with assessing whether they meet the eligibility criteria. Slide 17. The registrar has no powers of investigation, no power to discipline practitioners, no power to review the performance of SCENS practitioners, and no power to remove practitioners from the SCENS list. Slide 18. The bill specifically also provides that if a medical practitioner euthanizes or assists a patient to suicide without complying with the requirements of their regime, they and any other person involved are nonetheless fully immune from criminal or civil liability, provided that they acted in good faith without negligence. Slide 17. There are several, in the explanatory notes to the bill, there are several misstatements relating to the Lucretia Seals case. The evidence in Lucretia Seals case, it says in the explanatory note to this bill, demonstrated that without a change in the law, some people are suffering unbearably at the end of their lives, and that there was broad consensus that palliative care cannot relieve all suffering. This is not correct. The evidence in Lucretia Seals' case was to the contrary. It demonstrated that New Zealand is recognised as a world leader in palliative care and that physical pain and suffering can be well controlled with proper care. The evidence was that physical pain is almost never irremediable, and experts on both sides of the case agreed so that for the most intractable cases, palliative sedation is available. The unbearable suffering, which was the primary focus for Lucretia Seals, was the psychological and emotional suffering caused by her fear and distress at becoming dependent and disabled in the process of dying, and the loss of autonomy and control. And these have been the important part of Ms. Seals' life. Slide 20. Another misstatement in David Seymour's bill. It says that analysis from overseas jurisdictions where assisted dying is permitted demonstrates that concerns, including concerns about the abuse of the vulnerable, have not materialized and that risks can be properly managed through appropriate legislative safeguards. The overwhelming evidence in the CEU's case was to the opposite effect. International experts and the reports from these jurisdictions demonstrated very significant concerns with the operation of the overseas regimes. Reviews by independent tribunals, including courts in Britain, Ireland, United States, and the Scottish and British Parliament, expressed similar conclusions. The United Nations Human Rights Committee and the United Nations Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities have also expressed strong concerns. Slide 21, another misstatement in this David Seymour's explanatory note, that the state of the law in New Zealand is out of step with developments overseas. New Zealand is not out of step. Legislation of euthanasia is the exception rather than the norm, and in recent years only Canada, California and Victoria have gone down this path. Recent proposals to legalise assisted suicide or euthanasia have been considered and rejected by the British Parliament, the Scottish Parliament and in New South Wales. Euthanasia is illegal in every state in the United States, and assisted suicide remains illegal in 45 out of the 50 states. Over 140 legislative attempts to legalise assisted suicide in the United States have been rejected. Court actions seeking to legalise assisted suicide have similarly been rejected by the courts in Ireland, Scotland, Britain, South Africa, United States and the European Court of Human Rights. Next slide, slide 22. Every day we all spend hours with people who are facing death, whose greatest need, in my experience, is to be truly heard, truly listened to, not abandoned emotionally or physically. People yearn so much to receive care unconditionally. They are sensitive acutely to any sign that others feel they are a burden. When they sense this by a look, a tone, a pause, a lack of a pause, the pace of a conversation, they close down, retreat, and their overall suffering increases. International literature identifies that the main reason for people supporting euthanasia is not due to intolerable pain, but is instead people feeling a burden and loneliness. Euthanasia is not the answer to society's disease of loneliness. In a 2017 Otago University study of 72,000 frail elderly, a fifth, 15,000 were found to suffer from loneliness. The strongest predictive factor from the international literature for a wish to hasten death in those with terminal illness is hopelessness. Euthanasia is not an answer to society's disease of hopelessness. The word euthanasia disguised a practice which one might abhor if it were given another name, and the other name would be to kill someone. Let us take the protective cloak of medicine away in what is in fact deliberately ending the life of another person. Being treated with dignity is not only about self-control, autonomy, independence, and maintaining physical function. It is also present when one is honoured and treated with esteem. Caring lovingly for someone is itself an act of dignity and can provide dignity to another. Based on the statistics for the Netherlands, where euthanasia is legal and assisted suicide, over 6,000 people in 2016 received euthanasia or assisted suicide, which would be equivalent to 1,200 people approximately in New Zealand each year. This is clearly not a matter of two or three per year. Dr. Sandy McLeod has written in the past that the fatigued, hopeless and despairing doctor confronted by a patient requesting assisted suicide may more subtly encourage the act. Kelly et al. Wrote that clinicians burdened with the care of the very sick were frustrated by therapeutic impotency, struggling to communicate effectively, and seduced by the apparent rationality of the request, may become like their patients, supportive and implicit in quickening death. He draws attention to the complexity of a physician response to the care of the terminally ill, reflecting at times the physician's own sense of helplessness, hopelessness and demoralization. Physicians, like all other human beings, cannot entirely escape their own prejudices and biases about what constitutes quality of life and a good death. I have heard Glenn Colquhoun, a New Zealand GP and poet, say that medicine is a spiritual profession, and in the patient-doctor relationship, the spirit of the patient is exposed. In medicine, a science of the purely subjective, we encounter the ache of being human. This is a story. James Riley squirts whiskey through the gastrostomy tube, carefully syringing 20 mils at a time from the glass. I felt the tension between the frustrated nurse and the social worker at the multidisciplinary meeting. The social worker speaks in measured tones of the importance of this opportunity for abstinence for Mr. Riley now that he's an inpatient in the hospice. Why should we offer him alcohol when he could use this opportunity to reconnect with Alcoholics Anonymous? The nurse disagrees. James Riley breathes through a hole in his windpipe where green spit gurgles continuously. He is fed through a plastic tube ballooned behind his stomach wall. His finger mixes with the bubbling phlegm to cover the tracheostomy and give him a voice. Abstinence. He could abstain from breathing. He could abstain from feeding. He wants alcohol. This desire is in fact progress because last week he didn't want to live. I'm pleased today that his eyes are more alive and that he cunningly explores how to procure, imbibe, ingest and enjoy alcohol. The occupational therapist was eager to help him by providing 50 laminated cue cards with words beginning with I need, dot, dot, I want, dot, dot. So as he emerged post-tracheostomy insertion into the awful reality of a dual-tubed existence, Mr. Riley systematically reviews each cue card, holding us there as his audience, 1 to 50 each morning. On a round, I struggle to be patient as he. What does a doctor in training learn from observing this man's art of living? His feistiness, I want to drink. His directness, I want to die. These phrases were not options on the occupational therapist's cue cards. What does a doctor in training learn subsequently in a multidisciplinary meeting where the social worker advocates setting limits on the alcohol-loaded syringes that he relearned the benefits of abstinence? He will probably die within a month. The volunteer-directed drinks trolley swings by his room at night. Volunteering at night, they are blissfully unaware of our elegant plans for abstinence. Kindly volunteers unwittingly offer him sherry, Mr. Riley, or brandy, or whatever you like. Mr. Riley eagerly welcomes them in. Slide 23. As you all know, palliative care, the word palliative derives from a Greek or Latin word pallium, meaning a shield or a cloak. The idea is that palliative care team is cloaking or shielding the person in care, not able to remove or cure the underlying illness, but committed to not abandoning the patient physically, emotionally, or spiritually. What has Hospice New Zealand got to say on euthanasia? Their position statement refers to palliative care and the World Health Organization that palliative care intends neither to hasten nor postpone death. This philosophy is a cornerstone of hospice care in New Zealand. Euthanasia and assisted suicide of any kind is currently illegal, as we know, and Hospice New Zealand does not support a change in the law in any form. They go on to say, so from the experience, Hospice New Zealand says that they know that with the right palliative care, a person can have a good quality of life with their dignity maintained and symptom managed to help them feel comfortable as possible until their death. They continue, legalizing euthanasia will place pressure on vulnerable people, those living with disabilities, mental health issues, terminal illness, for fear of being a financial, emotional, or care burden. What does the NZMA say, the New Zealand Medical Association? It's opposed to both the concept and practice of euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. They say, and NZMA represents 5,500 doctors in New Zealand, that their position is not dependent on euthanasia remaining unlawful. Even if they were to become legal or decriminalised, the NZMA would continue to regard them as unethical. The NZMA submitted to the previous Select Committee inquiry, which was in 2016, and they said at that committee inquiry that the NZMA's code of ethics requires that doctors always bear in mind the obligation of preserving life wherever possible and justifiable, while allowing death to occur with dignity and comfort when it is inevitable. Allowing death to occur is fundamentally different from a deliberate act that has the primary intent of terminating life. We are of the view, the NZMA said, that permitting individuals to end their lives with the assistance of a doctor is contrary to the ethics of medical practice and would profoundly alter the ethos within which medical care is provided. If doctors are authorised to purposely terminate a person's life, however carefully circumscribed the situation, they acquire an additional role that is contrary to the nature of the doctor-patient relationship. Similar position statements have been issued by the British Medical Association, the Australian New Zealand Society of Palliative Medicine, Palliative Care Nurses New Zealand, and the Australian New Zealand Society for Geriatric Medicine. And returning to the bill, David Seymour's bill, it is an extraordinary feature of this bill that it proposes to carve out an area of practice and provide legislative immunity for medical practitioners who choose to act contrary to the ethics of their profession. Further, it obliges other medical practitioners who refuse to participate to nonetheless act unethically by requiring them to facilitate the referral of their patients. The 53rd World Medical Association General Assembly passed a resolution stating that euthanasia, just like the NZMA has said, is in conflict with the basic ethical principles of medical practice and encourages all national medical associations to refrain from participating even if it's lawful in the country. Of interest is that the World Medical Association, an international organisation representing physicians, was established after the war in 1947 in view of the participation of doctors in unethical acts during the war. The organisation was created to ensure the independence of physicians and to work for the highest possible standards of ethical behaviour at all times. And as I said, this was particularly important to physicians after the Second World War. The Australian New Zealand Society of Palliative Medicine submitted to the Health Select Committee, which is different to this at the moment we're now submitting to the Justice Select Committee on the same topic. So that organisation representing palliative medicine doctors confirmed the strong belief that euthanasia, again, is in conflict with the ethical principles of medical practice. They continued, those advocating for a law change to legalise euthanasia believe it will not affect medical ethics because doctors will not be forced to engage in it if they choose. This misses the point. ANSPAM's opposition to physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia is not based on personal values. It reflects the strong belief that physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia are contrary to the fundamental tenets of medical practice and inherently harmful. In my experience, no patient has consistently requested that I, as their doctor, end their life. A patient says, and may say, and this is hard, I wish it was all over. And our response as a palliative care team is to explore all the aspects of this statement, this plea for help. We that see that statement as an invitation to ask more, listen more, to be present and explore who is this person who is suffering. And from so many years of experience, we know that such an approach works. More recently, David Seymour spoke on Breakfast Television in November of this year, to which I responded to the New Zealand Herald. I was responding to David Seymour's statement, and he's an MP, as you know. He said that it's perfectly legal to starve, commit suicide violently in an amateur way and alone. It is legal and happens all the time. He continued, it is okay if a doctor intentionally ends your life by giving you too much morphine and claiming that's a double effect. All that is okay. All that happens without any regulatory safeguards whatsoever. Two sentences of my response to that, which was saying that from our experience as doctors, this is incorrect and to make such statements is defamatory. I said that if Mr. Seymour knows that he's incorrect, then he's misleading the people. And if he doesn't know that he's incorrect, then he's quite simply showing his abject lack of knowledge on this topic. The following few days after that opinion piece, I was surprised at the response of so many doctors in the place where I work, and a lot of them young doctors who ran up along the corridor even to thank me, and even I was hugged. And I think what they were just glad of, that someone spoke on behalf of our profession. I had the privilege of speaking on a Catherine Ryan Friday morning radio program some years ago. I explained to the listeners that the Prime Minister at the time, John Key's comments that euthanasia was happening in New Zealand hospitals already was untrue. I said that despite being the Prime Minister, John Key was actually a layperson in medical terms. And like many lay people, he confused the appropriate withdrawal of treatment, such as a ventilator in ICU, as euthanasia. While we, as doctors and health practitioners, recognise the clear distinction between that and a doctor intentionally ending the life of a patient. Again, on return to the hospital after that interview, I visited a man on the cancer ward. He had just that morning been told that his aggressive lymphoma had recurred. A kind care assistant was helping him into a reclining chair. He was a large man and he was crying. During that visit, he referred to the media reporting on euthanasia that day. He said, "I thought of killing myself several times in the last year, but now I know what hospice offers and palliative care. All I want now is palliative care." Another patient on the oncology ward that day was Jane Malcolm. As I walked into Jane's room, her father, Jeff, approached me to shake my hand, thanking me for my stated opposition to euthanasia on the radio that morning. It is interesting that Jane was 42 years of age, a lawyer, and had a brain tumour. About a year later, another 42-year-old lawyer with a brain tumour, Lucretia Seals, made headlines in her High Court application that her GP would not be prosecuted if the GP ended her life. Jane Malcolm and her parents took a different approach to Ms. Seals and her family. Jane was cared for at home by her parents, supported by community palliative care. Another story. A patient in her 80s was admitted through the emergency department of a hospital, having taken medications that she had collected over time, following advice she had received and recorded through the Voluntary Euthanasia Society. Her suicide note referred to recent recurrent falls, which led to fractures and a likelihood that she might fall again, as a result of which she would be, in her own words, condemned to existence in a rest home. She said that she wouldn't consider that life, having recently had experience of being in a rest home. She implied that she was driven to that drastic step of suicide because of that experience. She added that euthanasia would have been preferable with her family around her. If she lived in the Netherlands and if this bill is legislated that's before us, she would have satisfied criteria for euthanasia. Following admission to the acute hospital, this lady was cared for meticulously and with great attention to her physical needs, to her son's needs, with careful reduction downwards of harmful medications. We discovered that the pain medication patch, which had been increased in the community, was adding considerably to her anguish, which was being misunderstood as pain. After 2 weeks in the acute hospital, she was smiling, chatting contentedly, surrounded by flowers from her garden, photos of her son and her deceased husband. This lady in her suicide letter implied that the experience of care in rest home drove her to make the decision. I imagine the decision was much more complex. She was a highly educated lady, proud of her academic achievements, a member of the Voluntary Euthanasia Society. I have many concerns about the legalisation of euthanasia in the context of this story. My concern is the precipitant of the decision, her experience of the rest home. My concern is the side effect of strong pain medicine, the dose of which was increased unwittingly and due to inadequate knowledge that added to her distress. My concern is how she blossomed while receiving good care and how she suffered in the absence of good care. My concern is that people such as this lady are vulnerable and are seriously at risk of poor care and in the presence of euthanasia will be seriously at risk of being killed. Slide 24. It has been said that assisting in patient suicide hollows out the heart of the medical profession. It is the cheap and easy option for doctors, a simple, irrevocable, one-size-fits-all remedy that slides diagnostic thought, forsakes therapeutic options, and crosses a time-honoured barrier protecting patients from mischief. Slide 25. Professor Bozelink from Belgium, professor of oncology, has recently said in a book published in late 2017 that palliative care nurses finding the demands for euthanasia in Belgium an impossible burden and a complete contradiction of their initial desire to administer genuine palliative care. He said some Belgian palliative care units that have opened their doors to patients requesting euthanasia have seen nurses and social workers leave the unit because they were disappointed that they could no longer offer palliative care in an appropriate way. They were upset that their function was reduced to preparing patients and their families for lethal injections. Slide 26. These are some summary statements, phrases that I find summarise things well. Parliament has a duty to ensure that the degree of safety built into legislation such as the David Seymour euthanasia bill matches the gravity of the risk. And the gravity of the risk in this case is the risk to human life. Next slide. The safest course is not to license assisted suicide in the first place. Public safety must be paramount rather than personal choice. The international commentary by a bioethicist, Ed Pellegrino, said, some things ought never to be done to patients by physicians. Physicians must never kill. Nothing is more fundamental or uncompromising. Dr. Jean-Pierre, who is the Director of Communications for the International End of Life Society, spoke at St. Andrew's Church on the Terrace in Wellington in 2015, and I was in the audience. Dr. Jean-Pierre was responding to a question from the floor at the end of his lecture promoting euthanasia for New Zealand. The question was, what dose of medication does he use to euthanize his patients? He replied, phenobarbital to sedate and a muscle relaxant. And then he said, in relation to the dose, why be careful? Seated in the audience at the back of the church hall, I felt weak. As a doctor, I care for people who are facing death, and every day I try to be careful. I teach medical students why we need to be careful and how to be careful. Caring for and serving someone who is vulnerable, sick or dying requires great care. I was deeply troubled by the flippancy and the laughter among this largely pro-euthanasia group. Do they really know what this is about? By their proposed legislation, they seek to change the nature of our medical profession from care always to, well, why be careful? All my training, discipline and professionalism as a palliative medicine doctor is about being careful, being exquisitely careful with the lives of others. Slide 28. This is a triangle that I have created myself just to make sense of what I think the discussions are about. It may not be that clearly visible. I like the colours though. What I think is happening is that media and the public, we the public in society, are captivated by the top of the triangle, the individual stories, the I stories, the stories, very sad, extremely distressing stories like that of Lucretia Seals. Then we hear the views of other people on the media, then they do surveys and the answers to those survey questions will depend on how the question is posed. Then we have the responses of the media, then we have the responses of the politician, then we trot out statistics of how many are in favour and against. Then we hear from international what's happening in Belgium or other countries. Then we hear from the medical organisations. So as we go down the triangle, for me, what I'm most interested in is the bottom of the triangle, where I really think the conversation could be our deepest fear, our existential fear, our fears of dying, our responses to uncertainty, as a society, our responses to vulnerability, our understanding of caring, our understanding of suffering. And this is where I wish we had all these conversations. recently, this is just a little example of how life is now for patients. And it may not seem serious, but I want to tell this little vignette. So recently I visited a patient on a hospital ward. We weren't sure if they were dying. They had dementia, so it was tricky to determine prognosis. The family were very attentive and the patient was in a single room. So one Sunday early afternoon I called in because I was concerned that the families would be very particular about the patient's care. And the patient's daughter was in the corridor. So I thought I'd just call in and just check the patient out and say hello to the family. So as I walked in, there were two doors and then a curtain, and I couldn't actually know who the patient was because the curtain was drawn. So I called out, having knocked on the door, and I said, "Is this?" And the names, I've changed the names. "Is this Mr. Vansky?" Just checking that I was in the right room, because for one moment I thought I wasn't. And the nurse replied, as I peeked around the corner where there was a nurse and a healthcare assistant, and, "Oh, it's bed number 28. And I was a bit confused, so I asked again, because I thought I might be in the wrong room, "Is this Mr. Vansky?" who I still couldn't see. And they replied again, "Oh, it's bed number 28. So the family thought the care was good, but in my heart of hearts, I'm concerned. You know, this was a patient who had a name. Recently, at a College of Physicians round table where they were discussing their proposed position statement on this topic of euthanasia, we were in groups of eight at tables, and one of the organisers was circulating among the tables, and at the table I was at, they asked me which would I prefer, maid one or maid two, and I was perplexed, and then suddenly I was wondering, well, there's diabetes type 1 and diabetes type 2, so what's maid 1 and maid 2? So they explained medical assistance in dying type 1 and medical assistance in dying type 2. So the College of Physicians, it would appear, has added medical terminology, making this a medical procedure, and I was horrified. So, Philippa Malpass, who I understand teaches ethics in Auckland University to medical students, some years ago did a survey of older people who are members of the Voluntary Euthanasia Society. And it determined and it discovered that a lot of the reasons for these people being members of the Voluntary Euthanasia Society and being older people members is that their fear of institutionalized aging. So an aging person, it is assumed, will not be loved and will not receive care. So I groaned to read the study participants' comments, and this was a comment, "When I'm useless and have nothing to contribute. Does fear of growing old justify euthanasia? Does fear of being a burden justify euthanasia? If so, what a cruel society we've created. The inconvenient truth is that being a burden can happen at any age, infancy, childhood, teenagers. This is the very reason not to legislate in favour of euthanasia. In the court of usefulness, who will preside? How do we ensure that older people feel useful? What right have we to make them feel useless?" Quotes from the interviewees in Philippa Malpass' study are challenging. They said, "Older people are a drain on resources, and that's why they were members of the voluntary and in favour of euthanasia. Is this the reason to legislate for euthanasia? There's no limit to the drain on resources. We could say alcoholics are a drain, drug addicts, depressed people. The participants in the study see older people, in their words, getting little sympathy from caregivers frequently. Is this the impression we're giving to older people? This is the challenging area. The problem doesn't reside with the older people who request euthanasia. The real problem is that people in our midst feel they're a burden, and they feel or know we won't care enough. And maybe they're right. The easy answer for us is to bury the problem. The more uncomfortable reality is to look at ourselves, the carers, the able-bodied, and say, you know what, they're right, we don't care enough. We must show our older people and our younger people that we know how to care for each other." In response to Philippa Malpass's paper published in the New Zealand Medical Journal, I wrote a letter, and she responded again to me and in the paper. And she further expanded the possibilities of euthanasia. "A person may wish to end their life at a time of their choosing rather than using their financial resources to sustain a life which they no longer value, preferring rather to leave that money to benefit others." So as we come close to the conclusion of this talk, I want to refer to Margot Somerville, a bioethicist who lives in Australia. She wrote a book, Bird on an Ethics Wire. And quoting from Dr. Somerville, "The practice of medicine always and unavoidably involves ethical and moral issues. The push to abolish respect for physicians and other healthcare professionals' freedom of conscience reflects an emerging view that physicians are mere technicians able to provide service that patients want and have a right to access. as Randall and Downey explain, that in the setting of the patient choice movement and choice in end-of-life care, if patients are given unrestricted right to consumer choice, and if doctors are the agents of assisted suicide, then doctors will become the suppliers of goods and services in the free market. They add that such a position could emerge out of politically led consumerism, but if it does, the price will be the end of medicine as a profession. And as Professor Tony O'Brien has said, the beauty and benefit of the current legislative position, which is that doctors are not allowed to euthanize their patients, is that it is abundantly clear and absolutely explicit. So I'm going to finish with a story, but I'm mindful that the time is moving on, so I'm going to skip that story, even though I think it might have had a slide to go with it, but that slide will do. So in conclusion, the goal of medicine, and so the final slide, slide 30, the goal of medicine is not to give up caring. You can harm by a look, by a phrase, because of the vulnerability of a person who is ill. Such people are extraordinarily vulnerable, calling forth in us extraordinary compassion and care. We need skills and knowledge to know how to provide that exquisite, competent care. And a quote from the Nathaniel Report, an article a few years ago, and a little story. A man who had Alzheimer's disease and was dying had struggled for so long. He had endured memory loss for many years. All the while, his daughter had taken very good care of him. One day, towards the end of his life, she asked him, "Do you know who I am?" And he replied, "No, I don't know who you are, but I love you." Euthanasia legislation will hurt the profession of medicine and healthcare and nursing irrevocably. Euthanasia will expose further the vulnerable in New Zealand society. Euthanasia will not solve the aching loneliness of our broken society. Euthanasia will be a national disaster. Thank you. Jessica, ready to take questions?